You're listening to For the Record, a Registrar podcast sponsored by ACRO. I'm Ashley DeSantis, Assistant Registrar at University at Albany SUNY.
And I'm Jessica Lansing, Associate Registrar at University at Albany SUNY. And this is If I Had a Classroom, I'd Schedule It in the Morning.
Hello, welcome to For the Record. I'm your host, Doug McKenna, University Registrar at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia. In today's episode, we're going to be exploring the ins and outs of one of the most complex functions in all of higher education, academic scheduling. The sheer number of moving parts and competing interests associated with this process makes it fraught and sometimes frustrating. Fortunately, our guests today have wrangled with the academic scheduling monster and lived to tell the tale. So Ashley, Jessica, welcome to the podcast.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be here.
So Ashley, would you kick us off? Tell us a little bit about yourself. Tell us about your institution and anything else that you want to throw in and share.
Yeah, thank you. So we are one institution out of 64 that are part of the SUNY system, which is State University of New York. So we're a public institution. We have about 16,000 students in 2022, 12,000 plus faculty and an 18-to-1 student faculty ratio. And we also use PeopleSoft on our campus for our student information system.
Right on. And you are in Albany, which is in upstate New York. Correct.
Yes, Albany, New York, about 2.5 hours, 3 hours from New York City, north.
I'm sure you're familiar with the New Yorker famous picture where anything north of 125th Street is like the great.
Upstate.
Right. Yeah.
Yes, the great upstate. Debate. Yes. Yes.
That's right. Where I lived at West Point for 8 years of my life.
Oh, okay.
I was in the Army. And anytime I tell people that I'm from or lived at West Point, they're always like, oh, so upstate. I'm like, it's not really.
Mm-hmm.
It's
like 40, sure.
Like 45 minutes on the train to the city. So it is lovely to have you. Oh, go ahead.
I grew up around that area in New Windsor.
Oh, okay. Nice. Mm-hmm. We used to play New Windsor in soccer.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Big rivals.
Thank you for being here. I did not realize that SUNY had 64 institutions. Is that what you said? Is that accurate?
Yes. Yes.
Can that be true?
Yeah. Throughout the state, including the community colleges, the state colleges, and the university centers.
Okay. So for framing, though, for this conversation, you are not responsible for academic scheduling across the system, just at your own institution.
Just at our own institution.
Yes.
Right on. Okay.
Yeah. We're responsible for meeting SUNY regulations, but they don't have a say in how we schedule classes on campus, other than credit hours, of course.
Right, right. Contact hours. And we'll talk a little bit about meeting either system or state regulations and sort of usage, headcount, and utilization rates a little bit later. But would you give us an overview of your academic schedule development process at Albany? What
Perfect.
Does that look like?
Yeah. So before I give you that, I just want to say specifically our office, just to kind of frame it. So in the registrar's office, we have like three distinct areas. One is records and enrollment services. One is degree services. And then scheduling and grading services is the area I oversee. And that's a group of professionals who work on this like day in and day out. And we have four assistant registrars when fully staffed. Our office also utilizes a lot of student staff to be able to do like the customer service stuff so that we can focus on all of this kind of back office processing. And that'll be kind of important later on when we talk about one of the rubs we were kind of having with the schedule of classes. So I started at the university, well, Ashley and I both started together back in 2017. And at that time, we were kind of putting together what we call our academic space guidelines, or we commonly refer to them as scheduling guidelines. And these are kind of like our holy grail, right, of everything that we need to think about when scheduling classes, from contact hours to priority rooming, standard time zones, all of, you know, the checklist items. So we reviewed these like I honestly think it was like the first 2 months of our job. It was all we did, like all day, every day, was review these. We worked with our stakeholders. And then most importantly, we worked with the provost and we got their blessing on these. And then that's kind of our pushback all the time. We use these guidelines whenever we're working with departments to push back. And we say, hey, the provost has blessed these. You guys need to follow these guidelines. You need to like be meeting the contact hours. You need to be meeting in these time zones. And, you know, we just kind of continuously put them in their face and say, this is the path we are going to be on. So now that we have those guidelines in place, the process itself still has many phases and many stakeholders, but it's a little bit like linear, right? We have a timeline that we create every single semester from where we send out the workbook to when they have to turn it in to all the different pieces up until the posting of the schedule of classes for that semester. We work directly with the academic departments. They give us the data and then we kind of input it into the system. It's a very iterative back and forth process. Initial scheduling is the phase that, you know, takes up most of it. And that's really where they give us the data in an Excel workbook. We used to have a technology platform that we used, but it was cumbersome and it was slow, and it gave us back the data in a PDF, which was terrible to work with, and we couldn't sort, we couldn't filter. So we threw that out during COVID and we started using Excel, which kind of seems like a step backwards, but it really works so much better for us because we can customize it exactly to the data elements we're looking to get from the departments. We can put in, you know, preload the data so that they can select from a drop-down list. Oh, Ashley's got her hand up.
During COVID, we actually had IT write a program that will upload the Excel information directly into PeopleSoft to make class changes. So that was something pretty cool that came out of the Excel as well.
Right. And that was because during COVID, everyone had to completely change their schedule. And we said, oh my God, how are we going to do that? You know, with like T-minus 2 days till we publish. So yeah, so we get this Excel back from them and that's where the fun begins, right? So we start reviewing it. If they didn't meet the contact hours, we push back. If they try to schedule in a non-standard time zone, we, you know, we don't say absolutely not. We push back and we say, okay, why is this? And then we make them document the reasoning behind that exception to the process. And it has to be approved up the chain of command before we'll do it. So once that initial phase is done, we then go back to them and we say, okay, so now it's time to input classroom preferences, right? So the faculty tell them, I need this type of technology. I need this type of seating. I need so many seats in my class. Those are the faculty preferences that we consider. We don't consider any other things. And then we use EMS for this process and we run it through different scenarios and we try to room the entire schedule of classes. Back in the day, it used to be certain departments had priority scheduling or certain departments had priority rooming in certain buildings. It's no longer the case. It's really based on those preferences. If, you know, four departments need a 490 at the same time, you know, we'll look back historically, who actually meets that? This class always asks for 490, but they come in at 300. Well, then they're not getting that room, right? Like, unless they can show us, nope, the program has grown exponentially and we actually are going to meet that target. So we're really trying to kind of be fair to all departments, right? No one department has priority anymore. So during the rooming phase, like I said, we put all these scenarios in EMS. At the end of the day, we hope that every classroom gets a room, but that is not always the case. So the next phase of rooming is where we go back to the departments and we say, okay, these are your classes that didn't get roomed on the initial day and time. And they used to say, okay, we'll just put it in the next room smaller. And then we would do that. And then registration would happen and they'd need those seats. And then they'd say, oh, we need a bigger classroom. We said, we don't have a bigger classroom at this time, which is why we asked you to move it and you just changed the size. So now we'll no longer do that. We say, no, you need to pick a different day or a different time. And we let them know where the openings are. And so again, it's a back and forth process. And then we try to get it down to as many unroomed classes as possible. If those classes can't get a classroom, we'll say, okay, we'll either suppress you from the schedule and so nobody can register into your class, but keep checking back and maybe something opens up, right? Somebody will cancel or somebody else's enrollment changes, or we cancel the class because we can't put them on the schedule without a classroom if, you know, they said they have to meet in person. And so then we move to the next phase of scheduling final changes, right? So we open the schedule up again for changes because we're glutton for punishment. And like they change all of that hard work that we've done. And so this process, we love to say final changes, but it's never really finalized, right? We will make changes, unfortunately, up until through the first, second week of classes, although that process will change once there are students registered in the class.
So I have a bunch of, this is great. I appreciate the overview. I have a bunch of questions based on things that you said. And so I'll just throw these out. Who was involved in developing and or reviewing the scheduling guidelines document? Was that solely registrar's office? Was that a large group of people? Tell me about who was involved there. And then how did you get the blessing from the provost office based on who was involved?
Yep. So there was many stakeholders, registrar's office, academic departments, deans, department chairs, you know, facilities. We work very closely with our counterparts in facilities on these types of things. So they all kind of helped us review it. We have a couple of departments, right, who are always the ones we go to because they're very vocal, right? If they're the ones always making comments or asking questions, those are the ones we tend to go to more because we know that, one, they're paying attention, right? And that they're going to provide feedback, that if we don't ask them, they're still going to provide that feedback after the fact, and then we're going to change things. And
you're going to hear from them one way or another.
One way or another. So yeah, so we ask them for their feedback. And some of it we took, some of it we couldn't take, but it's always good to have the knowledge so that when we go out to the departments after the fact with these, we can say, like, we know that this might be a rub or that might be a rub, but this is why we had to do it that way, right? So that at least we can explain the rationale behind it. And then our registrar is so collaborative and she works so phenomenally with everyone on campus that she had really set that the foundation and groundwork for us because she had such a strong relationship with those departments and with the provost that when she brought this to them, they were like, yeah, this makes sense. We can see the need for this. We can support it. And, you know, she just helped us partner with them. And it was not an easy process, but I think it was easier because that foundation was laid with, you know, just years of collaboration and obviously being like the voice of reason and that kind of thing.
Yeah. And then some of the terminology, you talk about the time zones and those, I like to refer to them either as the standard teaching periods or the approved teaching periods. How did the time zones terminology come about?
I think that came about before we even started. Meeting patterns or time zones is what we will refer to them as. Yeah. And then we'll call ones that don't fit within the standard grid, like a non-standard time zone or non-standard meeting time, meeting pattern.
I think it's really interesting the way that some of the ways that we talk about the schedule develop at institutions. And so, and at a previous institution, they were just talked about as the time blocks. And I was like, but that's, people don't understand what that is, and it's difficult to push on a dean or on an academic unit when we're just talking about time blocks. But when you sort of invest in the language and give it some value, like these are the approved teaching periods or the standard teaching periods, and then they have to justify then why they need a non-standard something
Correct.
Or other,
yeah.
Which again, at some places is a lot more common. Like you'd almost think that the non-standards are standards based on how frequently non-standard setups are employed.
Right. Yeah. Right. I feel like when we first started, there was definitely many more non-standard than there are today. We've done a phenomenal job. And I say we, but I mean the assistant registrars have done a phenomenal job of really pushing back and making them justify in a way that is student-centric,
yes.
Right? Like, how does it benefit? And sometimes it's like, yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Like, we had a graduate program come to us, and they're like, listen, every graduate student in this program is a TA, and they need to teach the undergraduate courses at these times so they can only take classes. And we're like, yeah, that totally makes sense. And we need to do this for them so they can take their classes too. So there are times when it's has to happen. But a lot of the times it's because the faculty has an issue, you know, or doesn't like to teach or, you know, so as long as it's about the student, we're pretty flexible.
Yeah, it's really articulating those opportunity costs between. So if an academic unit comes to you and says, have got this non-standard course that I want to teach because this is when the faculty is available, but it crosses your time zones. That means that students they can't register into classes at either one of those times if they're going to take that class. And so it's really undercutting your students' ability to make progress toward their degree, potentially.
Absolutely.
Ashley, I cut you off. Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. I was just going to say that it has to be approved at the school level as well. And in our justification clause, it says faculty preference cannot be used. So it has to be for some reason that benefits the students.
Right. And to go back to something you just said, I think a lot of times the departments and or the faculty, they think that the only reason we won't schedule things on a certain time block is because of like classroom availability. A lot of times they're like, they think it's all about the classroom and they're not thinking about the student circumstances. And so how, like you said, it would take away their ability to register in another class, which could be the only time that that class is offered this semester, and then would put them behind, you know, degree progression. And so we try to explain that to them and all of the outreach that we do and all of the road shows that we went on. And I think another thing too that happens on our campus, and I'm sure probably happens more and more, is that it's not just conflicts with classes, it's conflicts with other things, whether it's if you have a non-traditional population, childcare for the student's family, right? Whether it's right. I'm taking care of my mom and dad, or I'm taking care of my children, the ability to work a full-time job while going to school, right? They need to be able to fit time blocks of work in as well. So like it's all of those, you know, and, you know, your students who are on athletic teams being able to fit in their practices and sporting events. So, you know, it's not just the classroom at the end of the day. There are so many other facets which need to be taken in consideration when making the schedule of classes.
Yeah, absolutely. I am really impressed at the description of the progress that you've made in terms of enforcing the scheduling guidelines. That's a great collaborative way to develop them, get blessing, and then actually sticking to them is a whole nother sort of ballgame. One thing that you also talked about briefly mentioned in passing were these priority scheduling arrangements. And you said you sort of peeled some of those back. What was the process there? How did you get units to agree to not have priority scheduling arrangements in place for either particular classrooms or particular buildings or at particular times of day? What was that process like?
Yeah, so we manage a certain set of classrooms on campus. So there certainly are labs and stuff that are department specific that they facilitate, but we have 153 classrooms across the three campuses. And we just said there is no preference. It is everyone goes into the same pool and it goes through the algorithm and it matches based on technology and room fill and all of those other kinds of things.
I think the catalyst, though, the reason that that works is because we began a huge campus construction renovation project. And so many rooms, and Ashley can talk more about this, came offline.
There was a literal burning platform that people recognized the need for change, or at least you could point to and be like, hey, all these are going away, so we need to think about things differently.
Yeah.
A majority of the academic classrooms are located on the academic podium, and all of those buildings are getting renovations. And so as buildings come offline, when they come back online, they're being renamed. So for example, we had the Earth Science building. It went offline and it came back on as Taconic. So that helps a little bit with the ownership or the feeling of ownership.
Right. Yeah. There's no more School of Business building. There's no more. I mean, there still are some that haven't come offline yet, the chemistry and those. But when they do come back online, they won't be named after the department that used to own the building. And again, I go back to our partnerships and collaboration. We work so closely with facilities and they are so on board with this because it gives them leverage when they bring these buildings back online to not designate so much space to the department that has the majority of that building that then doesn't get utilized. They hate when rooms sit unutilized. And again, going back to, we use EMS for our room, so you can see the utilization. There's reports that can be run. You can open up the platform and look at it. The departments don't put their rooms or didn't used to put their rooms. So there was no way to see. They would say, oh, we're using that room, but there was no way to really gauge, are they using it? Are they using it to capacity? Like, are they taking a 50-person room and putting a 6-person seminar in there? I think facilities was really happy to work with us when these buildings come back online to put the majority of the academic classrooms in the registrar portfolio for us to manage. One, I think it systematically, you know, ITS works with us as well, and we manage the technology in the room. And then there are certain standards and guidelines. And there's, you know, if it's our room, ITS will come in and they'll do the maintenance on the computer.
Yeah,
the departmentally, then the departments have to pay for it. So it just, it makes life simpler in some ways. Not for us. Adds a lot of work for us, but I think system-wise, it makes life
easier. We can handle it. So are there standards that you have to meet for seat count utilization or room utilization across the system? And then you mentioned EMS a couple of times now. Talk to me about how you leverage EMS throughout this process, and then also how you ensure that you're meeting the minimum standards for seat count utilization, room utilization.
Yeah, so our seat count room utilization has to be a 75% room fill. So they cannot put 10 people in a room for 50. And that is built into the algorithm in EMS. So once we collect all of the scheduling data, the departments enter that directly into what's called the CPI in EMS. And then the algorithm runs, and some classes are pre-slotted ahead of time. Some campuses are run differently just because of quirks on how that rooming works on that campus. But by and large, there's some cleanup in the end, but we've reduced our number of unroomed classes since we began implementing these strategies. In fall of 2019, when we really started pushing back, we had 190 sections that were unable to be roomed. And for fall 23, we had 32.
Right.
Wow.
So by kind of forcing them to go into these standard times and reducing the number of non-standard times, we have been able to greatly reduce that number, along with a lot of other changes that we've implemented to our standardized meeting patterns. Like additionally, we added a Wednesday, Friday, and some Monday, Wednesday, 2 day a week during the day. We reduced the Monday, Wednesday, Friday patterns. And we standardized all credit hours. Before, it was just 3 credits had standardized times. And we made times for labs, discussions, 1 credit, 2 credit, 4, 5, and graduate 1 day a week sections as well.
Yeah,
you weren't kidding around.
No, we put in a lot of work, and we keep calling them pilots so that we don't have to go through any formal process, right? We're like, we're going to pilot some new time zones. We're going to pilot this. And then everyone just gets so used to it. A couple of other things that we do is, one, we like over communicate so much with our constituents. So we send out at the start of every scheduling phase, the timelines, any and all rooms that are offline. We remind them, like, this room is still off, like our 490 is off. We're like, we have one 490, it's offline. Like, start thinking now about where you're going to put those classes. How are you going to break those up? And then we'll meet with those departments separately too, and have like a one-on-one. And sometimes we bring in somebody from the provost office if we feel we need to, but sometimes we can hold our own. And, you know, we'll work with them on strategies or crosswalks for how and where they can schedule these classes. You know, COVID was terrible, but there are a couple of good things that came out of it. One was some additional modalities or faculty willingness to teach an additional modalities that maybe previously existed. So we do some synchronous simulcast, right? So you get half your class sitting in front of you, half is online, but they register in those sections. There's no like deciding at the last minute if you're going to show up or not. Because again, we have those seat counts and they have to meet that fill rate for the in-person part of it. So that's been really helpful. And I will say, like, we are sticklers, no joke, with that fill rate. And like, if you all dramatically change and you say, oh, we're now going to need a 300-seater. Again, we look at the historical data. We love our data. We run reports all the time. We're looking at it. And if we don't see that you truly are going to meet it, we're not going to give you that classroom. And then one better is, as we get closer to the start of the semester, Ashley runs a report where she looks at that fill rate, and we've done some changes so you can't overfill a class. Every now and again, we find one that slips through. But if you're underutilizing it, we'll switch you out of that room if you don't need the technology in that classroom and somebody else does. So if you, you know, didn't really hit your numbers, off by a couple, but like off by 20 or 30, we're going to swap you out of that room. And we have, we had a room come up on a brand new room come up at a bizarre capacity that everyone told us they needed. And nobody in that campus can hit that fill rate. They can't hit 75% of it. So it'll sit empty. We won't let smaller classes in it because it's not a great learning experience for the students when like 30% of the classroom is empty. And so, you know, faculty sometimes get upset when they walk by a classroom and it's empty and we told them they couldn't use it. And then we explain to them, like, these are the guidelines. Like, this is what you have to do to get in that room.
Where are you pulling your data? Is it from PeopleSoft or is it from EMS?
PeopleSoft mostly. The reports in EMS, we have not found a way to really make work for us. So we're pulling most of our data. And then we also have a BI dashboard that was created in conjunction with the president's office and IR kind of through all of this project. And so anyone can get to that data now at any time, as long as you're logged into the VPN and you have a login.
That's pretty great. We're not endorsing EMS or PeopleSoft. There are a number of different scheduling software packages. Mm-hmm. And generally, they function the same. They have the optimizer capability that works okay in each of them. And so I just want to put a plug in to be like, hey, it's not an EMS.
It's not. Yeah, I think it's more the willingness of folks to work with each other, right? Yeah. So to make sure that the preferences being entered make sense and are truly what we need and that the guidelines are clear and they run multiple scenarios, right? It'd be so easy just to run one and be like, we're done. But they're like, if I run, and like Ashley said too, I think at one point, we pre-slot some classes, but not because of faculty preference. Like, we'll pre-slot computer labs because there's a finite there's number of computer labs, right? And so we want to make sure that we get those in before we run the scenario. And there are some specialized class labs, obviously, that, you know, like, you can't be in that room unless you're doing chemical engineering. So they're the class that gets that room. Or unfortunately, we have like one Mac lab on campus. So like the class that needs the program that only is on a Mac computer. So we do some manual, but I think a lot of it is too, is we run multiple optimization scenarios. And then we don't just take that as, you know, what it's going to be. They'll move. They'll say, you know what? I think if, sometimes we do this too. If there's a department that doesn't follow the guidelines and refuses to make changes, we will take them out of their pre-assigned classrooms and give it to a department that did better. Because we run numbers. Ashley said we use the BI. So we'll run a number. And if you are at like 30% on Tuesday, Thursday, and somebody else is at 60% Tuesday, Thursday, we're going to take that department and we're going to take their classes out. And we're going to give it to the department that did a good job. And
that's
so
amazing.
And so we tell them we and again, these guidelines give us that kind of leverage to say we will change your schedule if we have to.
Right. So you cannot have more or should not have more than 30% in any particular time zone. So Tuesday, Thursday, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And we also try to push them to spread it out across the days of the week or times of the day.
Right. Because everyone wants to teach in that golden hour, right, at lunch. But again, students can't only take classes in that time. They need classes at other times of the day. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, between 10 and 2, everybody. Right.
Yeah. But then we'll get some departments that'll freak out and they'll be like, oh my God, but I can't possibly offer a class at 7 a.m. on Monday, Wednesday. We're like, we're not saying you have to have a class in every single time zone. We're just saying you cannot only use like two. So again, like that 30%, we did a lot of research before we made changes and started on this process to see if there is a golden number out there. Like, is there a percentage that it should be below? And there wasn't really anything that we could find. So we kind of like looked at the number of classrooms we had and the number of sections we offer. And we, for us, 30% seems to be the golden rule. If we can get everyone to stay below that in any one given time, we can get to a point where we can room everybody who needs a classroom.
What is the distribution of what's your earliest class and what's your latest class?
We start at 7 a.m. and we'll go through, I think the last one ends at 10:20 p.m. So all day. And we have classes on Saturday and the weekend.
Yeah. But nobody's required to have a Saturday or Sunday, but we have a weekend every day program that obviously it needs to be there. And then those 7 a.m. slots were kind of created after the fact. We had science labs that were like, hey, we can't fit all of the labs we need. Our folks are fine coming in. So can we start early? And we're like, yeah, absolutely. You can start earlier. So
One piece of clarity about the beginning of your academic schedule development process. You start with the last like term, right? Yep. You roll spring to spring.
Correct.
Is there any coordination between the scheduling office and the academic units about what is being run? Or is that literally just you give them last spring to look at next spring and trust that they will review and revise appropriately?
Right. So we do the copy and then we basically create those workbooks. So we'll take the business, School of Business, and we'll take a snapshot. We copy all that data. We put it in. We do some manipulation to it before giving it to them to work off of. But we give them that workbook that's already preloaded with their courses. And then there are multiple tabs, right? So we give them a cancel tab if they want to cancel any sections, an add tab, and a change tab. And we very specifically tell them, please copy and paste from your complete data set onto these so that we get the course number correct, that we get the, because a lot of times they have typos and then that doesn't help us and we schedule things incorrectly. And then, like I said, that Excel will also have like different drop downs that's already pre-populated. Like, are you changing campuses? And then they pick the campus as opposed to creating an abbreviation on their own or writing things in. But we do trust them. So after we do that data entry, we have a report that they can run in PeopleSoft that we call the SVL, section verification list. And we say, go through it. We are human. We make mistakes. It's your responsibility now to catch those mistakes, right? And sometimes they're like, oh, I missed this on my spreadsheet. Can you please add it? Yep. And we go back and forth. Or sometimes we'll have questions. We'll be like, you put this on the spreadsheet, but it doesn't make sense to us. Like, can you explain what you're trying to do here? Sometimes things are missed and the schedule gets published and the faculty finally sees it and they say, that's not what I'm teaching or that's not the time. And then we make changes during that final changes period. And then sometimes they don't even catch it then. And it's like the first day of class and they're like, oh crap, we're wrong. This wasn't supposed to be like this. And we're like, okay. You were supposed to catch that. You were supposed to make that change 3 months ago.
And from what I understand as well from this conversation, you're having them fill out spreadsheets and send those back. They are not actually making any changes in any system other than Excel.
Yeah. So they used to have some ability to make updates in PeopleSoft, but then they would touch things they shouldn't touch and they wouldn't change all of the things. And so we know that there are some people who let them do the data entry right in there and then just run integrity checks. But we, at this point, think it's easier for us to do it. So we took all of their access away. They can now view only these screens and we make all the updates.
Yeah, it's probably better.
Yeah. And I think too, because we're never done making changes to this process or taking on more work, we recently rolled out we kind of worked on a new project that was to review all the requisites in the catalog to make sure that the requisites at the section level matched, as well as in our online catalog. And so we've been working really hard with the departments and undergraduate education in the graduate school to get all of that in line. So the notes have to match, the requisite groups, and all of these things have to line up. And so letting them have any sort of access to all of that would be, I think I wouldn't sleep at night.
It'd be very challenging. It's very challenging when you have a bunch of people, even well-trained, well-intentioned people make mistakes within the systems. And when the systems are integrated, those have ramifications.
Right.
So have you found that post-COVID, an increase in online offerings has reduced the demand for classrooms, has alleviated any pressure on classrooms, or is it just an added flavor in the academic scheduling mix that hasn't really had an effect one way or another?
So the university has really pushed to a return to pre-COVID scheduling. And so most of our offerings mirror what we had before, although we do have these additional modalities now that are available, like synchronous simulcast. And same, there's like alternating lab options now too, where like one group of students will come in on a Monday and then another group of students will come in on a Wednesday. But I don't think our actual number of online sections has really increased much post-COVID.
Right. So there hasn't been a real drawdown on the demand for classrooms or for classrooms.
No, no, there's still the same demand. No.
And I think we mentioned at one point that we have all these renovations. So I think it's so hard to really get a good estimate on that because each building had a different number of academic classrooms in it. And when they come online, they are not always coming online with the same number. So we're losing classrooms even when the building comes back online. And then we had eTech, which we mentioned before too, which was a brand new building with, I think we got 5 classrooms in that huge, huge building. So it's so hard because I think our portfolio of rooms is just ever changing, that it's not the same as we had pre-COVID, what we came back with. And again, having the large lecture centers too at any one time offline really changes. So we're having to offer more sections for the same number of students because like we don't have a 490 right now. So to get that class, they're splitting into 2 sections. So we're offering more sections. So the demand for rooms is up, but it's only up because that one room is offline.
Yeah. And those are the sorts of things that, as you said, at the beginning of each semester, you got to communicate out which rooms are offline now and which rooms are scheduled to be offline. And so that collaborative and open communication with facilities and with working on, you know, the classroom refreshes with either technology or paint or any of the reasons right. that a classroom could be affected, having that information early and communicating it out is really, really important.
Yep.
I know that we framed this in like you've gone through some changes. What problems were you trying to solve? I feel like we've talked about a bunch of the issues in sort of a scattershot way. So I want to just bring us back and actually ask you that question. Over the past 5 years, you have made some significant changes in the way you approach, the way that Albany approaches academic scheduling. Mm-hmm. How did it go?
Right. So, I mean, I think we had 2 really big problems we were trying to solve issues. One being that, are we scheduling for students or are we scheduling for faculty? And we were very faculty centered and we needed to flip that, right? Change the culture at the university. That was the first thing we tried to do. And then because we were faculty centered, right, it had impacts on the clustering of academic classes on 2 days and whatnot. And so we have like 3 funny faculty preferences that always crop up that we like to use as examples to really illustrate kind of where we were as a university. So we literally had a faculty member tell us that their class had to be offered in their building, which you'll remember we no longer have academic buildings, but he needed his office close in case he had to sharpen his pencil during class. We were like, first off, that makes so no sense. Like, who's using pencils anyways? And like, bring a little sharpener with you. But that was the reason the department's like, oh, we have to do a room change. And we were like, no, you absolutely don't have to do a room change, right? And so another one, you know, this mentality that our faculty couldn't possibly teach at 8 a.m. because they have to get their children on the bus. So we're like, all right, well, then we'll give you a class that starts later in the afternoon. They're like, oh, I have to be home because I got to get my kids off the bus. And it's like, all right, so your teaching window is again that golden hour between like 10 and 2, which doesn't work for our students. And this third one was, it's the most ridiculous thing. We had a brand new building come online, different than eTech. It wasn't a brand new building. It was a reno, but new technology, new desks, like, you know, everything that they've been telling us that they wanted in a classroom. And we scheduled this class, a language class, in this room. It fit the number of seats with a couple of seats to spare in case they got some extra students. But it was off the podium, right? So it was like a 7 or 8 minute walk from the podium to this building where this newly renovated classroom was. And sure enough, a room change request came in. It's a Tuesday, Thursday, prime time class. And we say, unfortunately, we have no other rooms that meet your preferences at that time. Students are already registered. It is like the start. They went to the first class and they were like, oh, I couldn't possibly make this walk, right? So we're like, the only room we have available is this like interior library room with no windows, no technology. I mean, nothing. It's like got some stacks and like old tables and wheelie chairs that are all mismatched. We're like, this is all we have. And the faculty is like, I'll take it. They were so crammed. Students were sending us pictures of like students on top of each other and like how just it was a bad experience for the students. The students were complaining. We went to the department. We're like, listen, this is where we are. And they're like, okay, well, let's change the room. We said, great. We have that room that you guys were in that has all the bells and whistles and it has space, you know, in this building. And they're like, oh yeah, our faculty won't move there. So they stayed in the less optimal classroom because that was the mentality. The faculty had the preference to stay there. And so it overruled the students being completely unhappy and not having a good learning experience. So we were like, okay, like this can't happen anymore. Like, how do we change this mindset? So that really got the ball rolling. And then Ashley, if you want to talk about the road shows and kind of how we got the buy-in.
Yeah. So we had this pilot and we went and we met with every single dean, every single college. And then we did a second roadshow where we met with every single department chair and academic scheduler. And we showed them their data and they could actually see that all of your classes are scheduled at this one time. And so when they could actually see it, it was a different story. And then we met with departments too that had more complicated schedules, like EOP with classes that meet every single day. And we crosswalked how the previous time zones would match up with the new time zones. So we really worked with them. We had open office hours. We had one-on-one sessions. And we were available for questions. And I think the provost also supporting all of our endeavors was crucial as well. I did have one thing to go back to the previous conversation. I just looked up the stats because I had it from fall 23 and we had 2,292 sections in person for fall 23. And in fall 19, we had 2,534. So we're really about the right same.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For the road shows, who was involved in putting those on? And how did you get buy-in initially to have people participate? This is like the buy-in for the buy-in of when you invite people to a meeting, sometimes they're like, yeah, I'll be there. And sometimes they're like, I'm going to send a designee and it won't matter. So who was involved? How did that unfold?
So it was myself, Ashley, and the registrar. And again, I think her years of building relationships with the faculty and the departments, right? She didn't just work in student affairs or work with those leaders. She really worked across the university and had a reputation. And so when she invites you to a meeting, you go to it because when you need her, you know that she'll be there. So I think that was instrumental in our ability to have these successful meetings. And I think sometimes too, we have such great relationships with the academic schedulers and, you know, the faculty that we do get to work with on occasion, the department chairs and whatnot, that then they would meet with us and they say, hey, I think my dean really does need to meet with you. And then they would convince their dean to get in a room and have that conversation with us. And there were times when after the fact, so we got the deans on board and then the faculty were like, what? So we had a writing and critical inquiry program and they were very coddled and they had a lot of preferences on when they could teach and when they couldn't teach and how they were going to teach. And so we got in a room with all of the faculty in that program and we listened to their concerns and we asked questions and they asked questions back and it was a really good conversation. And then out of it, we created some additional time zones because, again, we're human. What we thought were the needed time zones, maybe we missed something. And so we were very open to adding a couple more. You know, we met with graduate programs and they told us how they needed one day a week time zones. And we were like, okay, for your program, that totally makes sense. You can take one class on Tuesday and one class on Thursday and then they can work. So when we met with these guys, they were like, oh, it's a very high touch program. We need, you know, to have three classes a day. We need to have office hours and this and that. So we created some new time zones. And when we went back and looked at it, they didn't use any of those. And they went from having to be 3 days a week so that it was high touch to loving the 2 day a week. Like they literally now only use 2 day a week. So I think sometimes, right, change is hard, but how you manage that change and the fact that we were open to meeting with them and talking with them, I think then they were like, okay, well, they are listening to us and they are willing to add time zones. And so maybe we need to give it a try, right? And see how this works. And I think it does work. And we surveyed students to see, you know, how they felt about it. Because sometimes we think we know what students want, but we don't. And so, you know, we make changes continually. We continue to add new time zones or tweak time zones. And I think that helps. Yeah.
We were hearing too from the academic advisors that they weren't able to get students' schedules outside of Tuesday, Thursday, and then they weren't able to get all the classes that they needed to take because everything was at the same time.
Yeah, that's the flip to the student-centric scheduling model, where articulating the way that limiting student choices for registration affects their ability to progress through their program, and really connecting those dots for people whose, you know, frame of reference is, I teach this class and it needs to be on this day at this time. But there's the rest of the everything that has to go into it. So
yeah, it's hard to argue with somebody who, like, when we come at it from a student-centric point of view and we're saying, like, we're doing this for the student, it's hard for the department to come back and be like, well, no,
you don't care about it that way. Yeah.
Especially because I think it was very evident that we created a whole lot of extra work for the staff in the registrar's office. Like, what used to maybe take 4 weeks, we are now working on a schedule like for months to get all of those details, right? Because we're giving you that first iteration up front, and then we're giving you a second iteration, and we're doing the data analysis. And so it takes a lot more work from us to get it to the point where we are, but it's what has to get done. So I think, again, it's hard for them to say, oh, well, we're not going to do this, because it's not making our lives easier, this and that. We're doing it because it's for the student and because it's the right thing to do, basically. So,
yeah. What are the lessons learned that you would share out to anyone else who, or another institution who might be considering embarking on this kind of scheduling shift?
I think there's so many. I think one of the things that has been the best for us is that having that support, right, from those above you, right, having our registrar support us. And I mean, we have had difficult conversations with departments, and she was like, I would run it past her. I'm like, this is what I'm going to say to that team. And she's like, I support you 110%. So having that is crucial, because otherwise we'd have to back down. And the second you back down once, like, you then have lost it, and you're right, not going to be able to continue to push forward and make those changes that are necessary. I think the ability to realize that sometimes we do make mistakes, like some of the things we thought were going to be great and didn't work. And so being able to say, okay, we made a mistake, let's revisit it, or let's make a change, and being open and honest about that with the departments. And I think too, like, we added those open office hours, and sometimes they're great and they ask basic general questions, and sometimes we have really difficult conversations with the schedulers. And then we try to help them think about, because it's not always just the academic schedule, right? We're bumping up against so many different things in their realm, because scheduling is one small thing that they do.
Right.
And so we can't fix everything, but, like, we'll listen and we'll maybe give you some suggestions or recommendations. But I think just, you know, forging those connections with those departments, and they see us as people, right? Because we do it via Zoom, so they have to look me in the eye when they're saying these things to me. I think that has definitely been super helpful. Ash, how about from your point of view?
Yeah, I have a couple things, like with the data visualizations when you're sharing, make sure you have different types of ways of looking at it. Like, some people really like to look at numbers and other people are more visual. And just being able to provide that to people when they have questions to illustrate, you know, we're not trying to make your life harder. We're trying to make this better for everyone. And then when we were working with IR to create the dashboard, we had a lot of growing pains with the data itself. We were looking at it differently. And I think once we figured out that we were looking at it differently, we're like, oh, okay, we can know how to go from here. But at first it was like data integrity checks and making sure that I'm saying apples and you're hearing apples, but you mean apples. You're not really talking about oranges. So just having, like Jessica said, having tough conversations and not being afraid to kind of like push back a little bit.
Right. Yeah, I think there's another whole session that we could do on how to dig into the data, how to present the data, how to make data-informed arguments, how to, you know, do those data integrity checks and verify that things are good before you present it out to the units. Yeah. Because again, like, that's a one-shot deal too, where if you put bad data out in front of them, then they don't trust any of your data ever. So it's one of those things where you got to be very careful, but it's awesome.
I just have to say that I had a great team working with me on this project. And there were probably some times where they wanted to lock me in a room and throw the key away because we kept pushing, right? And it was not that it's not ever good enough, but like, there were times where it was really tough. There was a lot of work and you had COVID in the middle of it all, which was a whole nother level of work, but they pushed through and they did such a great job. And I think they feel empowered in their jobs enough to go back to the departments and say no, or go back to the departments and ask for more information or a better rationale. And so I think that, you know, with a different set of people, we might not have had the same outcome. So I think, you know, taking the time to recognize your staff and to celebrate their accomplishments and to celebrate the tiny milestones, right? So maybe we didn't get to here, but we did do this one thing. And so like just taking that time and, you know, laughing with each other at each other, like there was a lot, you know, along the way that happened, and faculty conversations. And so I think like it was just, you know, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into it, and it couldn't have happened, mm-hmm. I don't think, without them. So super lucky
Thank
to have
for saying
them.
That. Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. We're a team. We really are. So it is a team effort for sure. Because when they push back on us, Jessica always has our back too, and so she's always there to step in and be like, "Here's the
don't
hammer."
Don't talk to them like that. No, I'm just kidding. It never comes down to that. Everyone's usually pretty respectful.
Yes. Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, Jessica and Ashley, it sounds like you've done an amazing job. Continue the good work that you're
Thank
doing
you.
And carrying that banner for student-centric scheduling practices is Absolutely. Wonderful. So, and thank you for taking the time to be with us today and chatting about your experiences, sharing your knowledge and wisdom.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Yes.
There is so much to be said about academic scheduling. I feel like we just scratched the surface of the topic with this conversation. Thank you to Jessica and Ashley for taking the time to share their experiences with some relatively recent shifts in their academic scheduling approach. It just goes to show how critical building and maintaining positive working relationships is. Getting buy-in from stakeholders and support from senior leadership about what the rules and guidelines are, and then actually sticking to them. And above all, making that case for student-centric scheduling. Thanks very much for listening. Did you know that Acro now has a bunch of different podcasts available? If you haven't already, check out the admissions-focused pod, Admit It, or the transfer-focused, that's hard to say, the transfer-focused pod, the Transfer T, or the DEI-focused pod, Heard, Higher Education and Real Diversity. And of course, obviously, be sure to forward For the Record to all of your friends and colleagues. Take good care. Stretch your legs and drink some more water. Until next time, I'm Doug McKenna, and this is For the Record.
For the Record!